Looking back on the development of low and middle income countries, we've heard now once or twice that progress has been remarkable. The number of people living in poverty has declined. Girls and boys attend school, at least primary school. Mortality has been reduced by half. That's great success. However, that's only one side of the story. This progress has been severely unevenly distributed and unequal. This is true between countries and within countries. And my underlying hypothesis for today is that our ability to address this inequality will be the main determinant if we are to reach this grand convergence that the author suggests to be possible. The question, of course, is how. And in order to answer this question, and perhaps a few more, we've asked Professor Gavin Jamie and PhD Jesper Sundvall, two of the authors of the report, to present their findings, which main focus is options regarding financing for global health. Gavin Jamie is Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, where he also heads the Evidence to Policy Initiative. He's the editor of a series of academic journals and was one of the lead authors of the Lancet Investment in Health report last year. Jesper Sundvall is a program manager at EBA Secretariat, but has in this case been the author of the EBA report. He holds a PhD degree from the Karolinska Institute in Health Economics. After this presentation, we will complement the presentation by two other ones, and then we'll ensure that you have questions as well, and we'll have a coffee break in between. So thank you. Welcome, Jesper and Gavin.
So thank you for that kind introduction. State Secretary, members of the EBA, EBA Secretariat, and colleagues in Global Health and Development, thanks so much for the very kind, very warm offer to present the report today. It's a real privilege to be able to discuss it with you. I wanted to set the scene for the Global Health 2035 report. To first of all lay out who we are and why is it that the EBA approached us. Two of us are report authors. Dean Jameson co-chaired the Commission on Investing in Health that produced the Global Health 2035 report. Dean Jameson is also the director of the Disease Control Priorities Project. Helen Saxenian, a third author, is at Results for Development, a global health and development think tank in the United States in Washington, D.C., as is Robert Hecht. And Jesper Sundvall from the EBA Secretariat joined us as a co-author. And then we had a lot of research assistance from my colleagues, actually in Germany at a think tank called SEEK, and from R4D. So as we look back over the last 20 years in Global Health 2035, we also looked forward to the next 20 years. And that kind of framing of the next 20 years is really what EBA asked us to use, to sort of look through the lens of the future, to ask over the next 20 years, how might Swedish Development Assistance for Health evolve to meet some of the Global Health 2035 ambitions and goals, which we'll talk through today. And perhaps are there new areas or areas where Sweden could be a front runner or a leader or be particularly catalytic? We start in our report, which hopefully you will have a copy of and you may even have read. We start by summarizing the kind of key findings and implications for the future of development assistance for health. We then look at what we think are the big five challenges ahead. We found in doing this work, our first meeting was at Harvard in Larry Summers' office, we found that it was particularly useful to start thinking about development assistance for health in a new way, and that is, what are its functions and purposes? Traditionally, we classify development assistance for health by disease or by country that's receiving aid. We've done something a little bit different that Jesper will share with you shortly. We then looked at today's development assistance that Sweden supports and looked at what functions in global health it is supporting. We looked at Sweden's strengths in global health, and then we tried to pull it all together, and you can tell us whether you think we pulled it off or not. But essentially, we tried to tie the future challenges with the underfunded functions that we think are going to be important, with what Sweden does well, to lay out a suite of kind of policy options going forward that Sweden might consider in supporting Global Health 2035 goals. It is not a prescription, but a series or a suite of options. Global Health 2035, just to set the scene, 20 years ago, the World Bank published perhaps the most important, provocative, influential, controversial reports in health of all time. The World Development Report 1993, also called Investing in Health. And I was a medical student at the time. I don't remember a lot about it, except for this DALYS concept. It was the report that introduced this metric to measure the burden of disease, the disability-adjusted life year, very controversial. Why it was so revolutionary is that there was a health report not for health people. It wasn't aimed at a health audience. It was actually aimed at a finance audience. And at that time, finance ministers, who are probably the most powerful people in a cabinet, they tended to think of health as a drain on the economy. And this report actually argued the opposite, that investing in health is an investment in economic prosperity. And that actually there are a particular set of highly cost-effective interventions, TB drug treatments, for example, that even if you were a low-income country, there would be enormous gains from investing in. So 20 years on, 1993 to 2013, in 2013, we published a report with some of the original actors. So Larry Summers chaired the report, Dean Chamberson co-chaired the report. Larry was the chief economist at the bank at the time of the original report. 25 of us from around the world, health ministers, finance ministers, half to two-thirds from low-income, middle-income countries, academics. We spent 2 years thinking this through, how has health changed in the last 20 years? What have we learned from the past? But more importantly, over the next 20 years, can we look to the future and lay out an ambitious but hopefully feasible roadmap for achieving dramatic change in global health? We have five key findings, and I'm going to be just spending a minute or two on each. Our big findings in the report are, for infections, maternal and child health conditions, we can achieve a grand convergence in global health in our lifetime. The returns from doing that, the economic returns, would be profound and enormous. We think that the nature of aid is likely to change, shifting away from direct financial transfers from north to south towards some of the global functions that we have been neglecting. On non-communicable diseases and injuries, our report goes into a lot of detail about all of the possible things you could do, but we argue the most important will be fiscal policy, particularly taxing tobacco, alcohol, sugar-sweetened beverages. Mexico just passed a sugar tax, national sugar tax, and the removal of dirty fossil fuel subsidies. And on universal health coverage, perhaps the trendiest, sexiest thing in the whole of global health right now, universal health coverage, everybody wants it. No one really knows what it is or how you get there. We lay out what we recommend to be progressive, pro-poor pathways that affect the poor, that benefit the poor most from day one. On grand convergence, then, about 300 years ago, the world was converged. We all lived very short, nasty, miserable, brutish lives, that we all died young, and this was the common human condition of misery. But then about 300 years ago, and you can see this here in Sweden, you see child mortality rates plummeting and the poor world being left behind, a grand divergence in global health. But here you can see something curious. In the last few decades, China and other countries like Cuba, Chile, Costa Rica, for convenience we can call them the 4C countries, there are others, Turkey, Bangladesh, through investments in their health sector and, yes, other factors like economic growth, their child mortality rate has started to converge on Sweden's. And what we show in our report is that we are on the cusp of something truly remarkable and truly historic, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, in fact, an opportunity that is unique to this generation, our generation, has the technical and the financial capacity to see that most low and lower middle income countries could also converge upon the richer world if we make the right investments over the next 20 years. A global grand convergence in health. And if we do that, the benefits would be profound. We would be saving 10 million lives a year, year on year, from 2035 onwards. Yes, it's going to cost money. Some people get shocked when they hear the amount. It'll be about $70 billion a year from now to 2035. I don't think that's a large amount, and I think it's an extraordinary investment, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Most of those costs, not surprisingly, in low-income countries, would be on health systems strengthening, to build functioning health systems, health information systems, delivery systems. And an important finding in our report is you actually can't reach convergence with just today's tools. You are going to have to need new technologies. The way in which we showed that countries could converge, and we can perhaps talk about the modelling during the question and answer, was to look at aggressive scale-up of about 100 of today's health technologies, bed nets, breastfeeding, early exclusive breastfeeding, a whole range of vaccinations, diarrhea, pneumonia treatments, and so on. We assumed that you could scale those up to very high coverage levels, but even if you did that, even if you took pretty much every known effective medical prevention and treatment, you still wouldn't converge. We are going to need new tools. So this was a modelling exercise. There are certainly uncertainties about that. You heard me say already that the model assumes very high coverage, actually assumes that countries could follow Rwanda's example. Rwanda has achieved very high, 80 to 90% of children and women now are getting all the interventions they need on infectious and maternal child conditions. And yes, it's just a health sector model. We do not account for other development sectors, water, climate, education. We could actually probably progress more rapidly with investments in female education. And we don't know the exact role that new technologies are going to play. We do know from good data that poor countries that are very aggressive in adopting new health technologies, they see a more rapid decline in their child mortality. So we are quite, you will see, we are quite pro-science and pro-health R&D in this report. So I told you that we estimated $70 billion a year. There is an amazingly good piece of news in our report. Of course, these are just estimates, but one of our authors was the head of fiscal affairs at the IMF, and we estimate very rapid economic growth in low and lower middle income countries over the next 20 years. Enough for them to be adding $10 trillion to their GDP by 2035. So in fact, if low and lower middle income countries, if that economic growth is true, and they were to increase their health spending from current spending of just 2% of GDP to 3% of GDP, most of this can be financed domestically. And there's going to be new sources of money that I alluded to earlier. Taxation, removal of fossil fuel subsidies. Look, some countries, Bangladesh, Indonesia, India, they are spending more to subsidize dirty fossil fuels today than on health and education combined. We hope they will follow the lead of countries like Nigeria, which have been reducing their fossil fuel subsidies and investing that into the health sector. And of course, this report is in no way a retreat from development assistance for health. If anything, we are suggesting donors step on the gas, but there is going to be a reorientation ahead. Yes, about 22 countries are still going to be poor by 2035, fragile states, post-conflict states, and they are going to need support for convergence, but most will not be. they most will experience economic growth. And we know from very robust studies that when a country gets richer, it does inevitably spend more on health. We also know that the investment that is $70 billion a year sounds large, but our estimates are that you get back for every dollar that you invest in achieving a convergence, you get back up to $20 in return. Now, I know of no investment on the planet with such returns. And Larry Summers, if some of you know, has a history of investment banking, and he knows of no investment on the planet that gets you that in investment banking. It's probably the most profound investment you could get in human development. But we think that on development assistance for health, there is likely to be a shift. Some years ago, Dean Jameson and colleagues started to lay out some of the functions of global health, a very influential paper with Julio Frank and Felicia Knoll. And they divided the functions into core and supportive. Supportive functions are the traditional assistance, the transfers of wealth from north to south. But core functions that they laid out included providing global public goods, particularly R&D, managing cross-border threats, outbreaks, counterfeit drugs, antibiotic resistance, for example, and fostering leadership and stewardship. And the notion is that supportive aid matters when you are a country in crisis, particularly a conflict country, and that as countries grow economically on the spectrum towards an established market economy, the supportive functions become less and less important as they are economically growing. We did a very quick analysis for Global Health 2035. We've done a deeper analysis for this report today. Very quick analysis for Global Health 2035 that suggested that the most prominent development actors have really been neglecting core functions. The story of global health financing has been a very good news story over the last decade. We're up to $30 billion a year now, almost a tripling of development assistance for health. But the vast majority of that is still supportive. There has been a massive neglect of some of the core global functions, and we're seeing some of the result of that now in the Ebola crisis in West Africa. That trend that I showed you, where you expect to see countries as they are growing, where you expect to see donors spending more on global public goods, that hasn't really been happening. And we in our report call immediately for a doubling of research and development for diseases that disproportionately affect the poor. We are only spending about 1% of the world's health R&D on diseases of poverty, and that is not parallel to the threat. We should have had an Ebola vaccine and Ebola treatment a very long time ago. On non-communicable diseases, the only point that I'm going to highlight today is the role of fiscal policy. And if I could have one wish, if you said to me, Gavin, what is your one wish to dramatically improve health? If you could have one thing, it would be tobacco taxes. In China, for example, if China was to raise the price of tobacco by 50% through a tobacco tax, they would prevent 20 million people from dying, and they would bring in an extra $20 billion a year. When I first saw the numbers, the data, I thought that was a typo, but that is actually true. $20 billion a year in new revenue. And normally when I talk about taxing tobacco or taxing sugar, some libertarian or right-wing economist will say, but that is very harmful to the poor because the poor love to smoke and they love to drink Coca-Cola. You are harming the poor. But actually, they're wrong, because the data show that the benefits mostly accrue to the poor. It is the poor who gain the most lives. So we believe in the Commission that taxing tobacco is highly pro-poor. And lastly, on universal health coverage, we propose pathways that benefit the poor from day one by ensuring that the package that you start with in your universal healthcare pathway, that package is a package for conditions that disproportionately affect the poor. infections, maternal, child, reproductive health, and some of the basic interventions for non-communicable diseases, making sure that everybody gets them with nothing to pay at the clinic. It's all prepaid through public financing, through general taxation and social insurance. And that, of course, what that means is the package is narrow on day one, and then as you get richer, you can add more interventions. This is the Mexico story, and perhaps we can talk more about pro-poor universal health coverage during the question and answer. As we look to the future, Global Health 2035, we see five big problems ahead. The first is this unfinished agenda of high avertible rates of infectious maternal reproductive child deaths, mostly in low-income countries and the pockets of poverty in middle-income countries. Don't forget, most poor people are now in middle-income countries. The second is microbial evolution, the threat of pandemic influenza, the crisis of antibiotic resistance. The third is the crisis of non-communicable diseases and injuries. A fourth is this cost agenda, with 150 million people every year pushed into poverty from the high cost of medical expenses. And the fifth is that our system of international collective action is not fit for purpose. We haven't got a system in place that can deal with some of these global threats. I'm going to pass over to Jesper to talk about this perhaps new way of looking at development assistance for health and then breaking down Swedish development assistance through that lens.
Thank you, Gavin. So Gavin made the case for analyzing aid according to the functions it supports and presented the concepts of core and supportive, which run through the Lancet Commission's report. One of the purposes of this EBA report was to look at the Swedish aid according to function, and we felt, starting up that those two categories were actually not extremely fit for purpose, and it was making it too simplified. So we introduce, for that purpose, a new set of terminology with categories of global, local, and glocal. And global is basically the same as what we define as poor. And as Jameson et al. Introduced it in the late 1990s, is maybe mainly to handle what we can see at market failures, global problems that can't seem to mobilize financing. Local, on the other hand, we define as fungible aid to countries, the more or less traditional development assistance to finance service delivery at country level. And by fungible, we mean that it's easily replaced with domestic financing as countries get richer. Thirdly, we felt that we need something more, and that was the introduction of glocal. We want to acknowledge that there is still a role for bilateral development assistance in countries that are technically rich enough to finance essential healthcare themselves. And I think, again, Jameson et al., they put it in the terms of government failure rather than market failure. These are issues that governments are domestically unable or unwilling to handle. And it could, for example, be issues of marginalized groups or issues that have regional implications, for example, controlling malaria. And if we apply this analysis to the Swedish development assistance, what comes out? Well, first of all, let me introduce you to the Swedish Development Assistance for Health. This is a graph covering the last 15 years, and it shows quite an impressive increase. And it also shows, secondly, that the share between multilateral in the blue and the bilateral in the white has remained fairly constant. It's a division of about 50%, going up and down 60 to 40% ratio. In 2013, we reached about 3.9 billion of development assistance for health. Of that, about 60% went to multilateral institutions, predominantly Global Fund, UNFPA, and Gavi. And we had about 1.6 billion that's categorized as bilateral development assistance for health. If we do what Gavin sort of introduced and look at the multilateral support for global versus local function, there was a rudimentary analysis in the Lancet report, and this time we dug deeper with the help of people at Results for Development. And we went through the multilaterals that Sweden support with health aid and looked at what proportion of the multilateral agency spending can be categorized as global and what can be categorized as local. As you can see, glocal has disappeared, and it's not because we don't think it's important, but we didn't manage within this limited time frame to sort of sort out glocal. We believe the concept is useful for analysis, but we haven't sort of 100% landed in what should be categorized as glocal or not. It's a categorization under development. And we can see, going through Global Fund down to WHO, that we have from about 3% or 3.8, 3 to 8% of global spending in UNICEF to about 60% in WHO. So even if we have these multilateral institutions, which intuitively might seem that they're funding what we define as global functions, it's actually only 1/5 about Swedish development assistance for health that goes to these global functions. And that translates over the coming 5 years to about $2.3 to $3 billion. Or annually, what would it be? It would be about 400 million Swedish crowns. If we move to bilateral development assistance for health, three broad categories. And we're going to focus on what's called country cooperation, which is about 50% of the bilateral development assistance, or just below 1 billion Swedish crowns. The biggest country programs are in Zambia, Bangladesh, and the DR Congo. And you also have big programs in, for example, Zimbabwe and in Uganda. And when we looked at this, we could conclude that, yes, broadly, Swedish bilateral development assistance is supportive of the convergence agenda. There are many poor countries or low-income countries. There are fragile countries, DRC, South Sudan, Somalia, and Guatemala. And we see that and Sweden is phasing out support for the richest countries and phasing in support for one low-income country, Myanmar. So overall, you can say that Swedish bilateral development assistance for health is supportive of the convergence agenda. What are the implications then if we have economic growth in these countries? Well, looking ahead through the lens to 2035, which is the column highlighted in pink, we can see that if we use the Gavi cutoff point for when countries should be eligible for Gavi support, we see that only 4 countries would be eligible for this support in 2035. And you can discuss cutoff points, and you can discuss whether they're reasonable or not, and there are different angles you can take on this. But it's just an example to see there will be significant changes. Some of the countries that Sweden support today, like Bangladesh, will actually have, you know, an increase in their national income of about 150% in this time period. And it doesn't mean that Sweden shouldn't give money categorically to Bangladesh, but it means that maybe there is a case for revisiting the position that Sweden has towards these countries. If we do the same analysis as we did with the multilaterals and look at the bilateral development assistance according to function, we looked at data from the OECD DAC creditor reporting system, and we took all the bilateral support from Sweden, and we defined what was categorized as country projects as local support to local functions. These are the big country programs, for example, in Zambia and Uganda. But then you have a chunk of projects in the CRS, which is unspecified bilateral ODA for global and multi-regional projects. And this is by definition something that spans over more than one country. So we looked at that chunk of money, and we further disaggregated that into the three global functions that we have mentioned before: providing global public goods, managing cross-border externalities, and providing leadership and stewardship. And these are just examples of what the type of programs that would end up in each of these categories. For example, providing global public goods would be support. These are not necessarily CEDA projects, I should mention these. We have done this analysis for other countries as well. So, for example, support the international partnership for microbicides. We have managing cross-border externalities. We have supported the REACT network in Sweden, which worked with antibiotic resistance. And for leadership and stewardship, for example, support to International Health Partnership Plus, IHP Plus. So looking at the Swedish bilateral support, we end up with an analysis saying that about 15% of the bilateral support goes to global functions and 85% to local functions. Again, we think there is information there to further categorize into also glocal, but we didn't have the time for this study nor the resources. It requires quite a big investigative effort. And if you divide it further, you have about 60% of the global functions would be global public goods, 14% externalities, and 23% leadership and stewardship. Global public goods is an effect of quite large research support from the Swedish development assistance. Comparing this to other countries, we did a similar analysis for 5 countries. We can see that none of the countries have bilateral support that mainly supports global functions. We have a big range from about 7% to 44%. Norway and Canada are the big outliers, or the biggest difference in between. We also see within this global chunk that there are big differences if you support global public goods or other leadership and stewardship. And it's often coupled with big programs. For example, the DFID has a huge polio eradication initiative. Finally, if we add these two together, what is the overall picture? Well, overall, Swedish Development Assistance for Health translates into about 18% supporting global functions and 82% local functions, which to us was a bit surprising. Again, I mean, there's not a big difference between the bilateral and the multilateral. It's a fairly similar picture you get, that the overall majority of the funds are going to support local functions. With that, I hand back to Gavin again to run us through our recommendations.
So in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'm going to segue now to looking at what we think Sweden does particularly well and laying out our suggested policy options. And I really love Julia's description of the EBA as sort of dual independent of the MFA, and then inviting independent folks in. And it's really very much from that standpoint, and, you know, with some humility, that we came to this work. We are not sitting in Sweden with deep knowledge and deep expertise on Sweden. But what we were able to do, perhaps as outsiders looking in, was to dig into the literature, was to conduct expert interviews, and certainly in thinking through policy options from a distance, looking as outsiders, trying to marry what we think Sweden does well with what we believe from our analysis some of the gaps are going to be. This is really just a brief summary. There's much more detail in the report. But as we look in, we saw a number of areas where we think there is clearly enormous strength and excellence. I mean, Sweden is a very highly visible donor on the global health landscape. I've been to more global health conferences and meetings and donor fora than I could ever count. Sweden is a big player, very visible and very influential, far outside its size, or larger than its size. It is clearly a big player on sexual and reproductive health and rights, including family planning, including safe abortion services. It is a big player on midwifery, partly including support for UNFPA to provide midwifery services. It has been a leader nationally and globally on antibiotic resistance through, for example, the REACT network, and has a portfolio on research and development for infections of poverty, although we would argue that the spending, the total amount that we estimate to be about 200 million Swedish kronas per year, is, in our view, an underinvestment, given how important it is and also given the returns. And it is growing in its reputation and expertise on non-communicable diseases and injuries, particularly including road safety. Domestically, it is famous around the world. Everybody knows, wherever I travel, about Sweden's attempts to go for zero injury deaths by 2020. Perhaps not such a big player on the international stage. It funded the World Report on Traffic Safety some years ago, but could clearly step up in that arena. We also look to the future to say, well, what is the envelope perhaps going to be like in 2035? Now, these are projections. The first, in blue, assumes that Sweden continues to give the same percentage of its GDP to aid from now to 2035, and the same percentage of that aid to health, around 13 to 14% of aid right now to health. In red, we looked at whether, you know, what would happen if Sweden were to double that proportion. Right now, it's spending 13, 14% of its aid on health. What if it were to double it? Perhaps you think we're crazy. And then the third scenario is if it spends half of all its aid on health. And you can see the range from 3,000 million through 11,500 million kroner. So even under very conservative assumptions, there is going to be more development assistance for health. Why do we think a country might spend more of its aid on health? Are we just kind of biased? Are we just protecting our own empire of health? I don't think so. Maybe there's a part of that. But the implementation success, the record of success in development assistance for health, I think is really very compelling, particularly around scale-up of antiretrovirals, of malaria services. The science is really good on implementation success. And then the returns are spectacular. I mean, I showed the returns on convergence investments, but typically in global health, many of the benefit-cost ratios are of the order of 1 to 10. So we think there is a case to be made for countries to spend more. That's the range that we think is possible, and by 2035. There will be more financing available. And don't forget, of course, there are going to be a huge number of high-income countries and by 2035. So we're going to see a lot of donors. It's going to be an exciting donor landscape. So lastly, then, putting this together, the problems, the strengths, the underfunded functions. I'm going to whiz through just a few examples of each. I can't be comprehensive in the next few minutes. Just going to give you a flavour of this sort of range of policy options. Just a very quick overview of how we approach this. We said for the global functions, we should invest in those that are underfunded and that are crucial without any sudden interruptions. If you suddenly withdraw from AIDS programmes or malaria programmes, you kill people. Resurgence happens. We're not talking about sudden shifts. Build on your strengths. Synergize your financing with other sectors. Health isn't the only sector at play here. In looking at what local functions that Jesper was talking about you might support, assess fungibility. Could a country realistically pick up the funding itself as it gets richer? Yes, then perhaps DAH is not the right kind of funding. Similarly, for local functions, can it or can it not support it? Is it above or below the eligibility threshold? And in all cases, couple financing with policy dialogue. And just a reminder of the five big challenges that we're talking about, the unfinished MDGs agenda of infections, maternal and child health, microbial evolution, NCDs, medical impoverishment, and the need for a new sort of framework for international collective action. So, for example, on convergence, we know that what's at play is low coverage of health tools and services, underfunding of R&D, and underinvestment in health domestically. We know that Sweden has shown great strength in the scale-up of some of these tools and services, in doing R&D for these conditions, and in fostering national priority setting on health and health financing. So some of the opportunities ahead might be in the global realm, doing more on some of the global functions of multilaterals in support of the convergence agenda. Pooled procurement of commodities, for example, market shaping to bring down prices of commodities. On the global side, building national capacity to conduct research that would have global value. Scale up lessons for other countries has a global flavour. And on local, dialogue to promote increased investment. On antimicrobial resistance and the threat of global pandemics, Sweden does spectacularly well in this arena. And we think that here's one area where it could really be very catalytic, could be a front runner, could catalyze a new coalition, for example, of Swedish and international universities, delivery organizations, implementers, the private actors, to kind of ramp up our surveillance and control programs, and building national capacity globally on infectious disease surveillance. On NCDs and injuries, you could, for example, globally fund a program on adaptive research and development. So the interventions, the medicines, for example, how could they be used in low-income settings? Development of polypills that combine treatments, the development of heat-stable insulin for diabetes, for example, and globally building national capacity in conducting research on these diseases that has global value, policy, population, implementation, scale-up research, where the benefits go beyond that one country. On medical impoverishment, we know that Sweden is interested and has showing leadership in UHC, for example, from the the thematic consultation on health in post-2015. And here again, there are ways in which Sweden could help to build national capacity locally to conduct research on UHC, how you fund it and what the package might look like, what kind of health impacts it has, how you promote equity, and locally supporting national institutions on things like revenue generation, risk pooling, designing benefits packages. And lastly, this crisis in the international collective action system, that we are not ready for some of these big, shared global threats and challenges. We know that Sweden has had a strong global health metrics agenda, and we know that Sweden historically has backed multilateralism. We lay out a series of options, for example, two of the most important technical groups out there that are just trying to figure out how many women and children are dying. It's pathetic how they have to operate with virtually no money. I've just lent them one of my research assistants. This is nonsense. There's a brilliant opportunity here for a donor. And funding multilateral bodies to do more on norm setting, knowledge generation, on leadership and stewardship. And lastly, just to say some of the sort of how we're moving forward on some of this work, the classification is just a start. We certainly need to think through what GLOCAL really means in a bit more depth. There is certainly more work ahead on global health priority setting, and certainly a lot more work on costing of convergence and where the money is coming from. Perhaps the most exciting initiative in global health of recent weeks or months is the announcement of the new global financing facility for every woman, every child. It'll be launching in 9 months' time. Norway has given 600 million, Canada 200 million, and the World Bank IDA, through leveraging those grants, will give 3.2 billion. So it's $4 billion to start with. And we, my group, the Commission on Investing in Health, will be working very well, very, very closely with them. To look at how that fund might operate. It's going to fund global public goods and country plans and help transitionally countries to raise their own revenue. So we've today sort of looked at classifying aid for health by functions. We've suggested that Sweden is largely targeting local functions, that economic growth means that some countries are likely to graduate from direct assistance. We laid out these five big global health challenges. We argue vociferously and forcefully that Sweden really can play a key role in those challenges, that there is likely to be additional DAH, and that, you know, thinking this through in terms of function could be a very valuable approach for the future of Sweden Development Assistance. And just to acknowledge the research assistants who helped us out with some of the analysis. Thank you very much.